It is now time for Theoretical Tea and Company with Professor Janice Collins. So please, sit right back and enjoy a sip of knowledge right here on HitMix 88.9 WEIU, here for you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today on Theoretical Tea and Company. I'm your host, Dr. Janice Collins, here on the campus of Eastern Illinois University. It is wonderful to be with you all today. We have a very exciting show today, but informative. We're going to be discussing a new book that's coming out. Before beginning, let me first say that if you'd like to join us with the discussion, you can join us on Theoretical Tea Facebook account. You can post comments and questions and just send me a message. I'll try to get those on in the air. You can also Twitter me at Janice M. Collins, J-A-N-I-C-E M. Collins, on Twitter. Or you can phone in at 217-581-6116. That's 217-581-6116. Okay, let's get started. We got a lot to do today. We started a little late, but that's okay. Being here at the radio station that is run by PBS, we can go over a little late, too, if we need to. Well, it's 2 days before the release date of a book that's getting a lot of attention. The name of the book is Our Black Year. It's about one family's quest to buy black in America's racially divided economy. The author is Dr. Maggie Anderson, who is the CEO and founder and co-founder of the Empowerment Experiment Foundation. She's the co-founder with her husband, John Anderson. And she has quickly become the leader of a self-help economics movement that supports quality black businesses and urges consumers, especially other middle and upper class African Americans, to proactively and publicly support them. She has made numerous appearances on the national circuit, including at CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and CBS Morning News, among other national television and radio shows as well. She's received her BA from Emory University and her JD and MBA from the University of Chicago. She now lives in Oak Park, Illinois, with her husband, John, and their two daughters. Joining and collaborating with her for this book is Ted Gregory, one of our own from Eastern Illinois University, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and a very formidable partner in his own right. Well, recently, we had the pleasure here at Eastern Illinois University on behalf of the African American Heritage Month to have both of them here to speak with us about what the book was about, how they got started. And I really thought it was a great conversation that I wanted my audience to be a part of. And I know that a lot of you who listen to my radio show across the states and weren't able to be here for logical reasons. But what I did was I recorded the entire lecture and presentation. And I interviewed them afterwards. So I'll be bringing you excerpts from the interview as well as excerpts from the presentation so that you can join in on the conversation if you haven't already bought the book or actually did your research as well. And I'm happy also to introduce you to, once again, a guest that I've had on the show a couple of times, I believe, is Dr. Kevin Anderson is joining us here this morning. Dr. Kevin Anderson received his PhD from Missouri and teaches courses in American government, political theory, and African-American politics. His research interests center on American and African-American political thought, media, and American politics and African-American interest groups. He is currently working on a project that centers on the black intellectual and is the author of numerous publications, including a published book, Agitations, from the University of Arkansas Press. And I'm happy to report that he is also now tenured. So, Dr. Kevin Anderson, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation. So, ladies and gentlemen, before we get started with our discussion, I want to play for you an excerpt from the presentation that Dr. Maggie Anderson explained why she wrote. Well, first I want to start off with how did the whole experience begin why did she begin with the whole empowerment experiment? And this is what she said.
I'm excited about the chance to explain why my family created the Empowerment Experiment, also known as EE, the story behind our book, Our Black Year. For the Empowerment Experiment, my husband John and I decided to take a public stand to completely live off black businesses for 1 year, in honor of our business owners in our economically deprived neighborhoods, and in order to study and prove the power and importance of self-help economics in the black community. In 2008, we were just an average, middle-class, bougie black couple. My husband, a finance guy, had worked his way from Detroit to Harvard and earned his MBA at Kellogg, one of the most prestigious business schools in the world. I'm the daughter of Cuban immigrants who came here with nothing. I grew up in drug-infested Liberty City, Miami, made it to Emory University, worked as an aide for Congressman John Lewis and a speechwriter for the mayor of Atlanta. Then I went to the University of Chicago for my MBA and my law degree, where I learned constitutional law from one professor, Barack Obama, who later, after being my professor, decided to become the President of the United States of America. John and I fell in love while we were both in graduate school, bought a home in a nice white suburb, had two beautiful babies, and were living out our awesome American dream story. We had a perfect life. So what really motivated us to make this sacrifice, to take on this delicate, why don't black folks support each other issue, this is buying black racist issue, this why are black businesses failing while Asian and Middle Eastern and ethnic European and Hispanic businesses are flourishing and right in the middle of black neighborhoods issue? Or the why are we bragging so much about $1 trillion in buying power and have nothing to show for it issue, head on, voluntarily, publicly, and all on our own? Why do we invite this cruel world into our perfect little life? And really, what kind of difference could one couple make? That's just the way it is, right? There's never going to be an awesome American story like a Walmart or an Ernst & Young or Penny's or Hilton or Sears or Ford, Mars Bars, New York Times, Toys R Us, Dollar General, Polo, R.R. Donnelly, coming from a black family. These are all privately held American companies, or now publicly held companies, where the original family retains most of the ownership. Companies started by entrepreneurs no more talented than the kids in this room, no smarter than you, now passing on intergenerational wealth and property and security and traditions, investing in their neighborhoods, political groups, and candidates, recycling their riches, funding their school systems, growing their churches, providing role models and scholarships and the dream of entrepreneurship to their kids. That's what those families are doing. When are some of those families going to be black? We wondered about all that in 2008 as we watched my law school professor and my husband's hooping buddy from Harvard, a dorky guy who used to live around the corner from us on the south side of Chicago, a member of our church, become the President of the United States of America. We loved it, seeing Barack become President Obama. Now our children have a president who looks like that. But we still thought about the fact that most black kids can go their whole young lives and never encounter a business owner who looks like them. And for every other American child, regardless of their background, that essential encounter is an everyday experience.
And so basically, let's think about the idea in a nutshell. Okay, so basically, Maggie and John were successful. They were successful African-American professionals raising two daughters in a suburb of Chicago. But they felt uneasy over their good fortune. They used to buy their groceries, their clothes, what have you, all up and down the highways of Chicago and other places, and noticed that all these other sectors of town, of cities are doing well and striving. And they realized that what they didn't see were black business people. Why is that? Because it wasn't always that way. And so they thought to themselves, why is it that when we go into major cities, there's a Little Italy doing well? There's a Chinatown doing well? There's a Hispanic Action area doing well? And so they felt uneasy. They thought, well, what's going on? Are Black people not supporting their own businesses? Most African Americans live in economically starved neighborhoods. Why is it that when you drive down the street, you see maybe a liquor store or a grocery store, but all around you, there's no buildup of that looks like success? There's no rebuilding of buildings and businesses and entrepreneurship and things along those lines. According to her book, Black wealth is about 1/10 of white wealth, and Black businesses lag behind businesses out of all the other racial groups in every measure of success. One of the problems that she proposes is that Black consumers, unlike consumers of other ethnicities, choose not to support Black-owned businesses. At the same time, most of the businesses in their communities are owned by outsiders, meaning when you pay, you go down the street and you buy a meal down at a restaurant, that money does not stay there for very long to help build up that neighborhood. So on January 1st, 2009, the Andersons embarked on a year-long public pledge to buy Black. Okay, well, let's see what we can do then. Since no one's going to travel 50 miles to come to the Black neighborhood, Black side of the neighborhood, and promote and support the Black businesses, why don't Black people do it right there? You're living right there, so why don't we do that? So every day for a year, they drove 25 or more miles to find Black businesses. And they thought that by taking a stand, the Black community would be mobilized to exert its own economic might, just like everybody else. They thought by exposing the issues, Americans of all races would see that economically empowered Black neighborhoods benefit society as a whole. Instead, what they found was Blacks refused to support their own, and others condemned their experiment. And drawing on economic research and social history, as well as her own personal story, Dr. Maggie Anderson, in this book and in her empowerment experiment that she is now beginning to travel the country wide, shows why the Black economy continues to suffer and issues a call to action to all of us to do our part to reverse the trend. That's all of us. And when I asked her that, she said Americans, but mostly Black Americans. So, Dr. Anderson, that's a lot to take in. because there was at a point in time, as I said, that Black businesses were thriving and doing very, very well, as early as, you know, the 1800s, mostly in the 1900s, as they're building up communities and towns, and everybody knows the Rosewood and things along those lines. So what do you kind of sense from this, from your research perspective, your theoretical perspective? Give us a little bit of contextually your response to this, if you will.
Okay. Well, first, the one thing that sort of pops out at me is that this is kind of a consistent sort of philosophical argument through time, that initially African-American communities were, you know, sort of politically disenfranchised. They were socially and culturally and economically isolated. So Black businesses thrived due to sort of a captive market, that Blacks couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. They couldn't shop at certain stores, eat at certain restaurants. And so a lot of businesses evolved and grew based on the fact that people really didn't have a lot of options. But ultimately, especially early in the 20th century and further on, what you started to see was that economic power was fused with political power, that political disenfranchisement, sorry about that, stumbled over that term a little bit, but being politically excluded curtailed a lot of economic activity. There were loans people couldn't get. There were places where you couldn't build stores. There were suppliers who wouldn't deal with you. So you had a lot of things that, while you had Black businesses, their potential to grow was constricted by the political, political limitations in place at that time. But ultimately, the argument for economic empowerment sort of undergirds a lot of what you see. What would you recognize as the modern civil rights movement, mm-hmm. from Congressman Adam Clayton Powell arguing don't shop where you can't work, mm-hmm. To, this is sort of forgotten and sort of glossed over a little bit, But ultimately, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott is an economic boycott. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically saying we're paying good money and we're not getting the same treatment. Mm-hmm. So why are we going to continue to patronize a business that's going to treat us badly? Mm-hmm. So there's an economic concern, you know, at the root of all of this. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I, you know, that was the thing that sort of popped out at me initially is that, oh, okay, this is an argument that, you know, from Booker T. Washington to Marcus Garvey to Elijah Muhammad and you know, the Nation of Islam, all the way in through into, you know, President Nixon's engagement with black capitalism. Mm-hmm. President Reagan, in his own way, tried to develop a version of this. President George H.W. Bush had this whole idea of the ownership society. This is a sort of classic argument. And what I think the author is doing is embracing an idea of African-Americans taking control and saying and making conscious choices about where their dollars are going. Mm-hmm. And as a way of building a foundation within the African-American community. Mm-hmm. It's a longstanding idea. It is it's essential to the idea of a strong black community. However, and you made reference to this when you were speaking earlier, however, the problem you always run into is that the perception of what you're doing sometimes gets lost, because a lot of times people tend to think of these things as kind of either or. Well, if you're supporting a black business, you are, by doing that, attacking white business or boycotting white business. And people can't see it as we're trying to boost a particular community. Not, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a slam at any other community to say, in effect, well, you know what, I think I'm going to stop over here and drop off my suit to have it dry cleaned. You know, that's no slam on the other dry cleaners. Mm-hmm. It's a way of saying to the community, I know you're here. If you do good work, you'll be rewarded mm-hmm. with future business. Yeah. And, you know, the essential thing, and I'm certain she probably points this out.
Yes.
But the essential thing is not to patronize black business simply because it's black. You patronize it because they do good work. You know, mm-hmm. they meet a need that you have, right. whether it's books or, right. you know, good food at a restaurant or a dry right. cleaners.
Well, let's look at that. Those are some great points. And before we get off the I think this is a great time to listen to what Ted Gregory, a white male, had to say about the race card and the race issue and the race implication about this book and about this tour that they're on now, because he said that he had the same that he found from his that there was the same kind of reaction when he heard "By Black." Okay, so let's listen to what Ted Gregory, Pulitzer Prize winning Ted Gregory, had to say about this as he went through his own exploration and discovery of something different that he had not thought about outside of his white construct, of social construct. Stand by.
Well, I think it's an interesting and unique thing to African Americans. I think in this country, whatever culture you come from, if you support your own culture, whether it's Hispanics or Jews or Greeks or Italians or Asians, any culture really that supports itself to help grow and strengthen and stabilize that community, that's viewed in this country as being part of the American dream, as being almost a bedrock conservative value. But all of a sudden, when the African Americans want to do a little bit of that, it's considered racist. And when that was explained to me, it was like a little candle went on in my mind, and it started to make a whole lot of sense. And as Maggie and John explained it to me in my role as a journalist doing the story for the Chicago Tribune, I really grew to appreciate the logic and the effectiveness that something like the empowerment experiment can spread not only in the African-American community, but for everybody. It is, I think, a universal good if impoverished neighborhoods can stabilize, because there's a ripple effect with that, right? I mean, if the really rough, crime-ridden neighborhood stabilizes, then what happens to the nicer neighborhoods on the outsides? Well, they do better, too. So it's good for everyone, I think, if we can just get past that sort of initial knee-jerk reaction that this is a racist thing. We need to get past that, and we need to have a conversation that's upfront and honest and open.
Okay, now, what's actually happening is, you know, when you say buy black, and you go into businesses, buy black, like you were saying, Dr. Anderson, and what Ted Gregory and Maggie and Dr. Anderson were saying, that when you hear that, you get focused, a lot of people get focused on the race part and not on basically what they're saying about just supporting your neighborhood, building up your neighborhood, things along those lines. And so what is not being said, and I think this is when you deal with, well, what they found in the research is that black Americans, African Americans, are the only ones that have to defend and explain why they're buying from their own race and ethnicity. And what I mean by that is most areas that are predominantly white, they continue to support, according to the research, they continue to support white businesses, white banks, white grocery stores, but we just don't call it white. It's just the grocery store. However, if you go into Chinatown or if you go into other areas, Little Italy, they get the support, but they're not called racist. It's not called racist what they're doing. So we have a black neighborhood that the economic shortcomings are not necessarily black oriented. So what we find out is that this is the only race, according to their research with Kellogg, this is the only race, ethnicity group, that when they want to support their own out loud, because all the other races and ethnicities do that, but when they say they're doing it, even though if you go to a Chinese restaurant, you'll see other Chinese people. You go to a Japanese restaurant, you see other Japanese people. And that's almost seems like an exotic type of thing. If you go to a black neighborhood or a black, and you say, oh, I'm going to support this black restaurant, I'm going to support this black business because we need to keep money in the community to build up so we can be equal with everybody else. So then we won't have problems with socioeconomic injustices and things along those lines. People say, no, you can't do that. And what Ted said he discovered is, while he was saying that's racist, and he thought, well, I don't know, maybe that sounds a little racist to me, he didn't realize that when he asked himself, did he ever support a black business, he did not. So he was supporting just because of the way place he lives. He's not doing it because they're white. It is, so it's not a racist thing in the fact that it is by default because of where he may live, because of what he can afford. That is just by default that he actually supports white businesses. We just don't call it that. And so it kind of makes everything a little balanced, I guess, as far as the perception. What do you think about what they said?
Well, it reminds me a little bit of one of my former professors had a saying that he would sometimes give us to sort of get lecture going, and he would always say to us, safari stories would be different if lions could type. Mm-hmm. And it was very much a point in regards to perspective. And the example I sometimes give to my students is when I'm talking about this question, I said, well, you know, when I'm bored, I'm sitting at home and I'm flipping through the channels, you know, there's tons of channels, there's sports channels and movie channels and news channels and shopping channels and all of this. And I'm looking through there and I never consciously think that ESPN is a white-owned channel or that CNN is a white-owned channel. The only time when I was growing up that I was conscious of who owned the channel was when I would watch BET. And of course, BET is not a black-owned channel anymore, but it was for many, many years. And I think part of that is because of the sort of complicated history that African Americans have. Mm-hmm. That for so long, African Americans were, isolated socially, economically, what have you, that you know, in the great span of history, African American ownership and, mm-hmm. and sort of very sort of publicly being, you know, the face of a company or the face of a sports franchise or the face of, you know, America in the White House. Mm-hmm. This is so relatively new that it's almost always something that we're conscious of. And I remember growing up in Arkansas, I think that's a fundamental, there's a slight difference there in that mm-hmm. when I was growing up, I knew people who mm-hmm. owned businesses. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't particularly unusual to me. And I knew people that owned restaurants. I knew people who owned auto body shops and things mm-hmm. like this. And so I saw them, and they were very good examples. And I knew people that patronized them. And it was not particularly unique. Mm-hmm. And I think what the author what the authors both speak to is the fact that right now, as much as people want to say we're post-racial and we moved into this new era, it's still unique. It's still sort of interesting when we see a black person in a high-profile place. And so the idea of putting black people in control of the economic institutions in their communities, unfortunately, in 2012, this is still something of a novel idea when mm-hmm. it really shouldn't be. If integration and the full incorporation into America had been achieved, well, nobody would think twice. Well, mm-hmm. sure, there's a black-owned grocery store over there, and lots of people go, and it's not a big deal. But unfortunately, as successful as we've been in terms of political incorporation, there is the lag when it comes to economic empowerment.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think you brought up a really great point, too, that you can't, what they found is that you can't just support a black business because it's black, because you still want good business. You still want good quality. And what they found was some of them they could not support. Some of the businesses that they wanted to support, and they drove 25 or 30 miles to get to, because they actually did the research and said, what would happen? What would happen if we went in and we actually started shopping in our community, and, you know, would we see an increase of support from people? But some of the businesses were not good. And so, therefore, they took their business from that, as anybody would. As you said, you can't support it.
Right. And the other thing you have to keep in mind is black businesses are not always, you know, tethered to the black community. Mm-hmm. And again, I just making reference to something that I noticed when I was growing up. My mother always would patronize a friend of hers who ran a beauty shop. Mm-hmm. And initially when, you know, I was a kid, I can remember my dad going to pick my mom up, and this lady's shop was right in the heart of our community. It was probably 2-3 miles from our house. Mm-hmm. But much later on, she was so concerned about the crime and sort of the way that the community had sort of devolved in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. that she picked up and moved her shop way out into a predominantly white
sure.
community.
Yeah.
And so even though, you know, my mother and her friends continued to patronize this business, the business was no longer a central part of the community because other things had broken down
right.
so that the business couldn't stay there. Mm-hmm. But no, you're absolutely right in terms of understanding. He's like, well, you know, I want to patronize this particular business, but they don't provide the services or the products that I like or you know, that meet my sort of personal standard. Mm-hmm. And so do I sacrifice what I want as an individual to this larger goal of, you know, empowering the community?
Right.
And that's probably, I mean, I don't want to speak for the authors, of course, but that's probably where they ran into a lot of resistance and say, well, who are you to tell me that I've got a shop here mm-hmm. when I prefer to go over there and they've got, you know, product A, B, and C that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
So you run into this, and, you know, politically, one of the things I'm always sort of fascinated by, and it's not unique to African Americans, it's sort of unique to Americans in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. is balancing out the right of the individual, the liberty of the individual, the freedom of the individual, mm-hmm. versus the common good. What's good for my community? What's good for my neighborhood, city, state, what have you? And that push and pull back and forth, it creates such a difficult problem, mm-hmm. that a lot of times we just sort of let it go. It's like, well, you know what? I'm going to do what I like. If it's good for the community, great. If not, well, it's too bad.
Right.
And that's why sometimes when you see people go out of their way to support African-American businesses, people sort of step back. And, again, you get this very superficial, you know, thing of, oh, well, you're being racist. And like
sure.
I said, it's never dawned on me in all the hours I've spent watching ESPN that's a white-owned company.
Right, right, yeah.
That never crossed my mind.
Sure.
But when I would watch BET,
yeah.
I did think of that. Yeah. I was like, well, wait a minute. Right.
It shouldn't matter. Right, it shouldn't matter, but as Ted Gregory says, it's the American way.
Yeah.
To come in. The difference is for the most part, African-Americans who came over to the country did not come over freely. And so a lot of what was established at the very beginning, it took time to establish a culture that can be empowered by self-sustained economy and capitalism because of the different policies. We're not going to talk about individuals, but just different policies that are racialized and discriminatory. And their institutions and just the construct and the buildup of that, they were so very, very difficult. I'm going to allow Dr. Anderson to speak on that because there are two things that people also have to understand in what I've understood as far as reading the book myself and listening to the presentations and interviewing them. There is an economic infrastructure that has hurt the African-American community. So it's really not just a black thing that black people can't do it. There really is an element in the structure of this particular type of community that is somewhat different. But before we go to that, let me just play for her about writing the book, and we'll talk about some of the issues that you brought up in her soundbite.
We wrote Our Black Year hoping that, number one, we don't want people to think that this is just our story of living off black businesses for a year. We want it to be something that's inspirational. We don't want it to be about the Andersons and their extreme sacrifice. We want it to be about what all of us can do, all of our little sacrifices, and what that can potentially do for the community. What we really want people to do is think about where their money goes, what it can do, and how our not thinking that way has endangered our community. Because if we get to that level of just changing people's minds and paradigms and just getting people a little more conscious about how they spend their money, everything else would change. We have the money. We have some outstanding entrepreneurs. We have some corporations, well-intentioned corporations, that are ready to do business with us and make direct investments in our community. But we need to change how we think about ourselves, how we spend our money. We need to start thinking about economic empowerment in our community and not just the political franchise. We want that to be the message of Our Black Year, thinking about these important things in how our history here and our culture impact us economically.
And so what she's talking about is just the impact of, it just so happens we're African Americans. It just so happened that it's a black community that we're talking about because one of the sound bites that you'll hear momentarily, and I'm just going to let it play for a while. I'm going to let the audience just listen to the couple of things that she says. So it's going to be a minute. But she talks about the whole issue of, for instance, going into a store that supposedly was black owned and buying all these groceries, and someone happened to mention something, recognized her, and they had asked, and she said, oh, well, this is a black owned store, correct? And they said, oh, no, we just have black employees. And so what you'll find is the money that is spent in black communities does not stay in the black communities. The moment the bank deposits go off at the end of the day is when the money is driven out of the community, never to return, because the same individuals and companies that are benefiting from the businesses and the black-owned companies do not reciprocate and put the money back into the black communities. So she said, okay, that's fine. That's fine. That's the American way, fine. But why not black people? We need to start building up businesses and keeping it in the community so that there isn't all the other negative issues that come with, in the social environment of a low socioeconomic element, whether it's white or black. I mean, you could make this argument for poor white people. You can make the same argument in saying that white people, they eat white poor people or any poor people, Hispanic American poor people. If you cannot afford to buy organic vegetables, meat, good food, you're going to have high blood pressure possibly. You're going to have diabetes possibly. You're going to come home with the big bags of 99-cent potato chips that have 5,000 million milligrams of sodium, but that's all you can afford. So it's not necessarily a race issue as far as a problem. But go ahead, Dr. Anderson, and then I'm going to play this soundbite. I'm going to let everyone hear what we have to say, and then we're going to capsulize all of this. Go ahead, okay. Dr. Anderson.
Well, there's a couple of things that sort of stand out about it. One is that patronizing black businesses without then focusing, as you just noted, without focusing on the banks, without focusing on who gives the loans to build the businesses, without focusing on who's controlling investment, is always incomplete, just in terms of, because almost anybody will invest in a community if they think they can make money there.
Absolutely. It's a business deal.
It doesn't really matter if the consumers are black, they're white, they're Asian, Latino. It really doesn't matter. But the second part is, how do we develop that social consciousness that says, okay, I put a store here and people are shopping here and it's great for me. I now have the responsibility to put that money back in the community. Mm-hmm. If any of my students are listening, they're going to laugh because they've heard me say this before. But I love Magic Johnson. I think he's the greatest player in the history of the NBA. And yes, I know it's probably sacrilege to say this in Illinois. But one of the things about Magic Johnson that I've loved, aside from, his brilliant play on the basketball court, is that once he left basketball, he became the businessman who invested back in black communities. He built movie theaters. He built health clubs, 24-hour fitness. He built restaurants. When I have relatives who live in Los Angeles, and I was there, mm-hmm. and we went to the Magic Johnson Fridays.
Right.
It was a TGI Fridays. But he put these things in the community because he said, growing up, we didn't have Starbucks. We didn't have, nice movie theaters that, showed all the latest films.
Right.
And he had the conscience to say, I want to put this back.
Right.
And so that's the thing that has to go along with us as consumers shopping right. there. The people who own it have to have the conscience to say, I'm going to reinvest. Not only is this grocery store a good idea, but so is a Starbucks. So is a movie theater. So is, any number of other businesses mm-hmm. that at a certain point, once you get them established, they will thrive on their own.
Sure. And most importantly to be noted is every other racial, ethnic group uses the same formula. Every group, that's the American way. But the issue is that why, after being here for over 400 years, helping to build this country, African Americans are still at the bottom of the percentile averages data when we look at research and economic growth. So I'm going to play this. It's going to be a number. I'm going to tell my audience now it's going to be about two or three different sound bites combined together because I want to get it all out here and then we'll discuss it. But she's going to talk about why she believes and what she has found out from this major study landmark study with Kellogg that they have been doing. So it's in the numbers. It's not a personal thing. It's not a personal opinion. It is statistically significant and found in the distribution of the variables. So let's take a listen to see what Dr. Anderson has to say about a lot of this. If you want to call in and make a comment or a statement, please feel free to do so either on Facebook, on Theoretical Tea, or call at 217-581-6116.
That essential encounter is an everyday experience. Everyone knows that's true. Everyone knows it wasn't like that before. Our neighborhood kids had the groceries, the fresh marts, the dry cleaners, the drug stores, hardware stores, department stores, owned by local entrepreneurs, just like in every other community. We can't forget that. We have to remember that. That's what this month, this occasion today, is supposed to be about. Today, I want us to remember those businesses, those pillars in our community, those brilliant, talented role models that used to be common, and remember that time when the sense of duty and stewardship and shared destiny in the Black community permeated our culture. I hope that today we'll remember how those businesses kept our neighborhoods and our families strong, and how our desire and drive to support them made us shine. I hope that today we'll think about them, because they're gone now. All that's gone, and that's, I say, why Black people live at the bottom. That's the reason our children don't have local role models, our fathers, mothers, brothers, and sisters can't find jobs, our schools, parks, community centers are underfunded, and businesses and economic centers in our neighborhoods are not thriving and beautiful like they used to be. It's the system, and it works, and there is nothing illegal about it. It may feel racist. It may hurt like racism. Some racists, I'm sure, enjoy the way it all plays out, but it's no one's fault but our own. And what's worse, we didn't even seem to care about it anymore. Well, my family cared, and a lot of people in this room care, but caring is not enough. We have to do something about it. So we did do something. We created and conducted the empowerment experiment, believing, because of people like you, that it doesn't have to be so bad. We did it. Everything we did and went through, we did it to be able to get here, to be with you, unite with you, inspire you, especially the young kids, with our little story. We want you to be a little more accountable for our future and believe, like we used to, that we're better than our circumstances. I'm so very proud that we lived off Black businesses as much as we could. I'm blessed to have had the opportunity and wisdom to see that pledge through. Yes, we're disappointed by the number of markets and industries where we suffer from lack of representation. We're disheartened by our own people's lack of pride and solidarity. Our hearts ache as we saw up close what our people have to go through in these retail and food deserts, forced to settle for inferior goods and high prices, enduring disrespect from owners who won't live with us, sometimes won't even hire us, but use our money to send their kids to college and pay for their dream vacations. It was painful hearing the stories of quality entrepreneurs who could not even get their own people to lift them up. And it wasn't just that. It was tormenting, begging my own people to support Black businesses and give nothing but, oh, I tried years ago. Like they've never had a bad experience at a white-owned, Middle Eastern-owned, Korean-owned, or Hispanic-owned business, and without fail, go right back. Today, at Easter, I want to take some time to examine and discuss what Black History Month means, what Black people have meant to and done for this country. Today should be about what this community has done and needs to do again about our economic empowerment. Today, for Black History Month, while you honor me in this special way for the great book, I want you to remember some other people, those people who died in the fields, factories, and farms, working and slaving for others, building up other families' riches and industries that still exist today. Today is about them then being freed, only to get lynched, raped, shot at, and jailed, and their homes and businesses torched to the ground for daring to do what those fantastic entrepreneurs in our book dare to do. Just set up shop, offer the community a good of service, and expect to be valued. All that just so I can have the chance and blessing to be able to support businesses owned by people who share my history, retain professionals who value me, and buy products from businesses who care about my families and my neighborhoods. All that just so that some of you could have the opportunity to be business owners and business leaders, not just good employees. They went through all of that so you could own businesses, create jobs, and contribute more to our legacy in this great nation. Young people, I want you to start setting your sights on taking a real stand. And it can't just be about getting a big job at a big corporation like Walgreens or Johnson & Johnson or Hilton or General Motors. These firms would be nowhere without the black consumer. We've been here 400 years. Does it bother anybody in this room, as Americans, not just black people, that none of them are black? That you can't even think of a great American institution like that that comes from the people who helped build this country? Are you ready to try to change that? Will you think about that when you study our freedom fighters and civil rights workers? Will you think about the fact that black entrepreneurs are by far the greatest private employer of black people? And then think about another fact, that unemployment in the black community is twice, and in many places, three, four, or five times that of whites, and the highest among any ethnic group. So maybe if we had more successful black entrepreneurs employing our people, our unemployment wouldn't be so high. Do you see the connection I'm trying to make? I'm sorry. We love you and I cherish you, but I got to give it to you straight, especially my young black people in this room. As African-American students, you just don't have the right to do what folks like me have done. You see, my generation has developed this dangerous sense of entitlement and gratification. Like it was all about us, all of the marching and struggling and getting jailed and killed. So all I got to do is live well and buy nice things. For that simple and superficial opportunity, most of us have traded in our righteous sense of connectedness and consciousness. It bred laziness, renders us idle, and robbed us of the hunger and passion and humility and creativity we needed to make a difference in this world. It happens to so many young black people. I know, because before the experiment, I was one of those people. Then fortunately, I got my moment. It was in that moment I learned that I just don't have the luxury of giving up on my people or giving in to the status quo. I just don't have the right to live that empty and easy life. I can't just keep choosing between living King's dream and fighting for that dream. I remember that moment when I thought about all those feelings of shame and inferiority I get every time I walk into a mass retailer and see black people all over the place, but nothing made or distributed by us. Or when I stroll through a black neighborhood to see not one thriving black business owned by the people who live there, except for a couple of fried chicken shacks and a barber or braid salon. In that moment, I absorbed the indignity of my generation allowing, after all we've overcome in and contributed to this great nation, allowing our entire population to be reduced to a humongous consumer segment, a reservoir of wealth through which every other group's communities could thrive. I thought about the fact that in the Asian community, a dollar circulates among the community's banks and retailers and business professionals for up to 28 days before it goes to outsiders. In the Jewish community, that circulation period is 19 days. For WASPs, it's 17 days. For Hispanics, It's 7 days. You know how long it stays in the black community? 6 hours. I considered how the media and our so-called leaders and the politicians, they don't ever talk about those 6 hours when they talk about the black situation. They don't talk about the fact that black people employ the most black people. They don't talk about that. They talk about how many of us are in jail, shooting each other, and dropping out of school. The good news is that the empowerment experiment is changing that.
And so when she talks about empowerment, she talks about the empowerment experience and all of that. What I think that she's saying and what I got from her interviews is that it is not about white or Hispanic, or she said not to, you don't want to boycott any business and say, oh, don't buy from them anymore. Oh, don't do that. No, that's not the American way. The American way is African Americans, black Americans, these are your neighborhoods. These are your businesses. People must do more to buy businesses, own businesses within that neighborhood that needs to be improved so that their money can stay in that neighborhood longer than 6 hours. Now, when I heard that data, I was stunned because I haven't done the research. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about when I go to Kentucky Fried Chicken or when I go, you know, and you look in a small neighborhood, in a small town, you can think. I think we came up with one black business in the place of, in Charleston, I think it was. And it was a doctor. We believe that he has a private practice here in Charleston, possibly. But other than that, and it's okay to go to other businesses and to go have, you know, shop at Walmart, shop at, you know, eat Mexican food and Chinese food and pizza and Italian and all that. It's okay. It's great. It's great food. It's great people, whatever. But what are you going to do about your own power? Empower yourself. I don't know. I mean, that's what I got from it. So it's not against anybody or any group. It's really about pulling yourselves up. When they say pull yourselves up by the bootstraps, stop asking for handouts. And that's what I thought she was saying, listen, we got to do this.
Well, to me, she struck a couple of chords.
One, okay.
One was the idea that it's borrowed. It's an old idea. But W.E.B. Du Bois in, I think it was 1903, wrote an essay called The Talented Tenth, in which he sort of argued that the middle class and upper middle class, whatever, had a special responsibility to their less well-off brethren. Mm-hmm. And whether this was through education, whether this was through social and cultural activities or economic activities, you had a responsibility to step back into that community and improve it. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what she said sort of resonated with that argument. And ironically, a lot of what she said that was sort of negative reflects Du Bois himself. In 1948, he wrote basically a sort of sequel called The Talented Tenth Revisited, in which he basically sort of said, well, this isn't going to work because I didn't account for the sort of selfishness of this middle class and upper middle class black Americans, that once you achieve a certain level of status, you stop being worried about your less off brother.
And that's what she was referring to.
And that's what she was referring to as well. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, there's been a fairly sort of, again, to go circle all the way back to the beginning, there's been a certain sort of consistency to this. I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s, there was an attempt to get in on that sort of youth market. You know, everybody was wearing, you know, Nike and Starter and all this kind of thing. It's kind of a carryover from the late 80s and early 90s. And so you had the company FUBU pop up,
mm-hmm.
you
oh,
know,
yes.
For
us,
by us. By us.
Uh-huh.
And so you've had these type of movements, they kind of spring up. But the problem is these things are difficult to sustain without sort of larger systemic changes. Now, yes, there does require a commitment from people in a community that says, when we get something in this community, whether it's a grocery store or a coffee shop or a movie theater, whatever it is, we have to make a sustained effort to shop at that store, to support that business, to make sure that that business, you know, makes enough money to stay here and serve, you know, the people who live here. Mm-hmm. But also, there's got to be a way to change the bigger rules to make it wise to invest,
okay,
to make it worth a bank's time to loan money to, you know, a black man or a black woman with a great idea, mm-hmm, that says, I want to do this, and there's profit to be made here, and there are services need to be provided. And so we're going to need, and, you know, this may be, you know, the fact that I'm trained in politics, and so I tend to think politics first. But in order to engage economic development, the rules of politics need to follow whatever it is that we tend to think is the most important thing.
Okay.
The example I gave my students in class once was, I said, we were talking about urban government. I was like, how many cities have been blackmailed by their sports teams that have said, oh, hey, if you don't build us a stadium, we're going to leave? Mm-hmm. And the argument they consistently make is, if you build us a stadium, it'll bring this many jobs. It'll develop, you know, there'll be sports bars and hotels, and everybody's going to want to come downtown and come to the game, and they'll shop and do all of this. And leave aside whether or not that argument is actually accurate, because there's a lot of evidence that it's not. But we have to say to political leaders and to people, you know, in the financial industry, look, there is money to be made. You can commit to this.
Yes.
And if you commit to this as investors, we will commit as consumers. And that's the important thing.
And I think that that's another interesting point. Recalling from the presentation, she had asserted that, for instance, if you're going to sell businesses clothing, for instance, apparel in the black community, why not hire a black business that actually makes the buttons or anything along the line? So invest. So you're saying black people can't just do it themselves. There's going to have to be some policy changes or at least. Go ahead.
Well, no, I guess what I was going to say, okay, is that economic empowerment is it's a powerfully seductive argument, but it can't be singular.
Okay.
It has to go along with other things.
Right.
Because, you know, again, going all the way back to Booker T. Washington, who embraced the idea of economic empowerment. And the flaw in his argument was he sort of left political rights off to the side, because he made the assumption, like, well, once we prove ourselves economically, then political rights will be bestowed upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no. These things are so intertwined that they have to go together.
Okay.
And so that's what makes them sort of essential.
Right. And she was saying, I guess she was asserting and arguing that you're talking about to sustain and maintain,
right,
any type of growth, which was what was absent and has been absent because someone dropped the ball. And we're going to let her have the last final word here. And I apologize to my audience if I'm Dr. Anderson and Ted Gregory if I'm misinterpreting what they're saying. But the best way to handle that is go and get the book. But I want her to say about all that it takes. What does it really take?
And all it takes is not marching on anybody, not taking anyone down. It takes everyday people making personal commitments to every day just put a little bit more money into those businesses who employ the chronically unemployed and put money back into underserved communities. We absolutely think we have the seedlings of a movement here. We've been around for 3 years now, and probably in this experiment have gotten more exposure to the issue of economic empowerment than any of our civil rights leaders in the past and any of the leaders we have currently, as far as being in the media and being at the universities and being at conferences. And we're just a little family. Imagine what we can do once we get more organizations involved and more of our business leaders and more of our universities. We definitely have a movement already. And I think that this movement can lead to some real change in our community in the years to come.
And so on that last final word and what she is propositioning as far as what needs to happen is basically live the American dream, revise, change, update, improve the American dream so that everyone can flourish and be supported and living just a prosperous life that can be allowed here with all of the rights that we have here in America. It's not perfect, but it's a great place to live. And I think people can really respect that and really appreciate that. And as I have to say that a lot of the other races and ethnicities in the audience, they have come back and emailed me and called and said that they've started to read the book and actually understood a little bit more what was being said. And so they get it because it is an economic issue that we're talking about. So with all that being said, we're at the close of the show, about 30 seconds left. So I want to thank Dr. Maggie Anderson and Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, reporter Ted Gregory for allowing me to record and share the information that they have collaborated in their writing in the culmination of a book called Our Black Year. It is up and ready. You can buy it online and get that for sale if you wanted to read more about it yourself. I also want to thank, again, my special guest here in the studio, Dr. Kevin Anderson, for joining us today and assisting us in expanding our understanding of issues that are deep, ubiquitous, and at times troubling from an academic and historical perspective. Thank you so much for coming in to helping us make sense of all of this.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. And I apologize to Dr. Anderson and Ted Gregory if I misspoke or misinterpreted your work, but I wanted the audience members to actually hear from you, from your words, what you meant. And so I hope I've done that quite effectively, at least to the point where if you have any interest, you can always hit them up on email, on the internet, or buy the book yourself. So in ending, I'd like to dedicate this show, as usual, to someone. I'd like to dedicate this show to a young woman, an entrepreneur, when we talk about that, in her own right, who became an empire of talent and a raw truth in the face of challenges and controversial attacks over the years. Of course, this show is dedicated to the great and late Whitney Houston. May she rest in peace. I hope everyone has a great afternoon, and take care, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in to Theoretical Tea and Company. Please join us next time for another sip of knowledge, right here on HitMix 88.9 WEIU, here for you.